You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Sweden in Focus, the Local's podcast looking back at the week's main news in Sweden. We usually record on Thursdays, but as there's a holiday this week, we're recording this on Wednesday, May the 26th. Later on the show, we're going to talk about Sweden's famously flat workplace hierarchies and whether they're conducive to actually getting stuff done. We'll also discuss Swedish attitudes to alcohol. We'll explore the Swedish media landscape, and we'll have a brief progress report on Sweden's NATO application. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and with James Savage away this week, I'm on my own in the Stockholm studio, but I'm lucky enough to be joined for today's podcast by David Crouch in Gothenburg and Richard Orange and Becky Waterton in Malmö. Hello, everybody.
Hello. Hello.
David, welcome to the podcast. Really good to have you on here. You are a regular contributor to The Local, and you've also written a book about how Sweden works called Almost Perfect. What else should we know about you?
Oh, thanks, Paul. Well, I'm a Brit. I'm a journalist. I've been in Sweden now for almost 9 years, which is a bit scary. And I think I bring a much needed representation to the pod of Gothenburg, which is Sweden's finest city, as you all know.
Not sure Malmö would agree with that.
What does Gothenburg have going for it, David?
The thing I like about it is it's got a city feel to it, but it's actually quite small. So I live in a little leafy village outside the city, but on my bicycle I can be right in the centre just in 30 minutes. So it's just easy to get around.
Good. You're not going to hear any arguments from me. I actually spend a lot of time in Gothenburg and like it quite a lot. What about Malmö? Have we talked about Malmö before? What's good about Malmö?
Well, you know, Malmö's just got a city feel, but it's a small town. And, you know, I can cycle around so easily. So it's completely different from Gothenburg, you know. Absolutely not the same. But no, yeah, Malmö's also got that kind of going for it, that you have everything you want without it being overwhelmingly large. And then if you ever don't have anything you want, you can just go and get the train to Copenhagen and you've got a capital city half an hour away, which is nice.
Good stuff. Stockholm's not bad either, I have to say. Is everybody happy enough with David's credentials? Can he stay?
Yeah. Let's never get James back.
Okay, last week we talked about how Turkey threw a spanner in the works when President Erdogan announced his country would not ratify Sweden's application to NATO. What's the latest on that, Richard?
Well, yesterday Turkey sort of published a set of demands on its website and also sort of tweeted it out in about 11 different languages, including Russian, which I found a bit strange. And those were more or less what we knew already. They wanted concrete assurances from Sweden, who they accused of supporting terrorist organisations. And one thing that was interesting is they referred to PKK/PYD, which is PYD is the political party that dominates in the autonomous region of the Kurdish autonomous region of Syria. So they completely conflated that in their statements, which does make it a little bit difficult for Sweden to then go back and go, no, but these are two separate entities and this one is not terrorist and this one is terrorist, because right from the get-go they're saying this is one entity. And that probably isn't the best starting point for negotiations. But one thing that was, and they also highlighted the money that Sweden's given to the government in the Kurdish region of Syria. And they also talked about the arms embargo that Sweden placed on Turkey when it started fighting against Syrians in northern Syria as well in 2019. And then it reiterated the call to extradite people it called terrorists linked to the PKK, PYD, and also to the Gulen movement. So it's pretty much what was expected. Over the weekend, Magdalena Andersson had a phone conversation with President Erdogan, which, again, after that phone conversation, Erdogan came out once again with all of these demands, and Andersson sort of came out with platitudes about how important it is to fight terrorism, but didn't actually, in her statements after the call, didn't talk about any of the specific points that Turkey's been raising.
Interesting, yeah. And has Turkey singled Sweden out here, or is Finland being subject to the same treatment?
I think it's pretty clear that Sweden is the target. And it seems like Ann Linde, the Swedish foreign minister, is particularly a target. And this is something I didn't know about, but a few years ago, she held a joint press conference with Turkey's foreign minister, which was really tense. And this was around 2019, when the Turks had started fighting in northern Syria. And she was to, you know, hard demands to pull out, and it got very heated. And since then, apparently, in the Turkish media, people know who Ann Linde is. People know about this. This is a very live issue for Turkey. And in December, she met the Kurdish government, the PYD. So, and at that time, I suppose, Sweden didn't know it was going to join NATO. So yeah. didn't realise.
She even tweeted a picture of them and wrote something like, wrote her support for them. So it's not that she's been very open with this.
They've been a very open backer of the PYD. And also Sweden's defence minister, Peter Hultqvist, was on this list that a think tank linked to the Swedish ruling party put out a list of European politicians that were seen as PKK sympathisers.
You mean the Turkish ruling party?
The Turkish ruling party. They put out a list of people seen as PKK sympathisers, and Sweden's defence minister, Peter Hultqvist, was on that list. So this is something that I think has been important for Turkey for a long time, but it just something that hasn't been in the Swedish media. So we haven't realised that Turkey has this Sweden problem.
A big thank you to everyone who has taken our survey so far. We do really want to hear from as many listeners as possible. So if you can, please visit the link in the episode description on your app. We're going to turn now to alcohol, and I know this is something you're writing about at the moment, David. One thing you're looking at is a study comparing Nordic countries. What is the study, and what do the results tell us about Swedish attitudes to alcohol?
Well, it's an annual study by IQ, which is owned by Systembolaget, the state-owned chain of liquor stores in Sweden. But this year it's different because they've compared attitudes to alcohol in four Nordic countries, in Denmark, Norway, Finland, and Sweden. And some interesting things come out of it. Obviously, you know, with statistics, you're generalising, and I think individual attitudes do vary. But Sweden does come out as being clearly more kind of cautious or uptight about alcohol than the other Nordic countries. Just one example which struck me was that only half of, it's well under half of Swedish people, 45%, say that it's okay to occasionally get drunk, which, given the number of times that I have been drunk during my lifetime, that was a really surprising statistic.
You use the word uptight, David. Might Swedes prefer to call it responsible, do you think?
Yes, I'm sure they would use the word responsible. And that word sort of permeates so much of the discussion around alcohol in Sweden. But at the same time, I think there's a fair bit of hypocrisy in all this. In my own experience, if you want to get a social gathering going in Sweden, the best way to do it is to uncork the gin and let it flow liberally. Swedes enjoy alcohol just as much as anybody else in Europe, possibly even more so. And yet there is this semi-official sort of national guilt about alcohol, which is embodied, if you like, in the state alcohol monopoly, the aim of which is to control and keep down alcohol consumption.
And where does this guilt come from?
Well, it has deep historical roots in that about 100 years ago, Sweden had a serious alcohol problem. Really, the statistics on consumption, on vodka consumption, are really quite scary. And for decades, the country struggled to reduce alcohol consumption, until they hit on the idea of a state monopoly in 1955. But that deep-rooted attitude is expressed in all sorts of ways. So Sweden, which is, you know, has this reputation of being a very modern, liberal country, which is in love with its personal freedoms, actually has a very significant temperance movement, which has more members than most of Sweden's political parties, and quite a lot of influence.
I think also I think a lot of people, I only came to Sweden 2 years ago, So I think a lot of people maybe don't know about the history of Systembolag. You used to have a ration book that you could only go in and buy a certain amount of alcohol a week, and they came and kind of stamped the book so they could see how much you'd bought. There was like a ban on buying alcohol if you were a registered alcoholic. So some people were completely banned from buying alcohol. It was like a pharmacy. There was no self-service. You had to go in, and this is why they've got those little numbers when you go into Systembolag. You have to go in and say the number of what you wanted, and they go and get it out of a cabinet for you. So my husband's from Skåne, which actually had the last counter service Systembolaget in the whole country. So there was a bottle of vodka that was referred to as a halvbøy, like a half bow, because it was kept under the desk. So the person that was serving you had to go and half bow under the desk to get it for you. So I think that's also kind of... Systembolaget has adapted and it's become a lot more liberal. Just even the idea of self-service alcohol in Systembolaget was kind of revolutionary. So I think if you kind of know the history of what it used to be like, you're like, wow, okay, so they actually ended up letting people choose their own alcohol and all of this. I think that also kind of gives a bit of important context.
I mean, my wife's family are from northern Sweden, sort of working class, and they all grew up within this temperance movement, both of her parents. They were still completely teetotal until their 30s or something. And now, you know, they drink boxes of wine like everyone else, but they still drink very sparingly. So when I got married to my wife, I've sort of had all of these loads of people came first when we were buying the alcohol. They were like, well, you need maybe half a bottle of wine a person. I'm like, what, make that like two bottles of wine a person? What are you on? And then when we had the reception, which was sort of in this lovely seaside town in north of Stockholm, and suddenly my friends came up and went, there's something wrong, the champagne stopped, you know. So then I went and found the people we had serving, and they said, no, well, your mother-in-law said that it should only be one glass per person. And I'm like, just bring it out. She thinks people might get drunk. And I'm like, the people should get drunk. I mean, that's the whole point.
And, yeah,
and it was this clash of attitudes to alcohol. She thought that everyone should be very measured, should only have one glass at a person. No one should get noticeably drunk in the wedding. And, you know, I think, you know, when people arrive at a wedding, you want them slightly tipsy straight away.
Your mother-in-law, according to this survey, which came out just a couple of months ago, your mother-in-law is in good company, and well over one in five Swedes say that it's wrong to get drunk at a party. And that figure is much higher, significantly higher amongst women. But as a Brit and coming from a country which has an alcohol problem, you know, it has problems with, if you go into any town centre on a Friday or Saturday night, you can see that the country has an alcohol problem. In theory, I can totally get the Sweden's very unusual approach to alcohol. In theory, I can see that it's different. It's a different sort of product, and it should be regulated. And there is this is an example of society kind of taking overall responsibility for a product which can cause a lot of harm, a lot of costly harm as well. When you think about the cost to the health service and so on. It's in practice where I get so... Well, don't get me started about Systembolaget.
No, let's get started. Let's get me started.
I find that it just is sort of so ridden with guilt. The thing that gets me, one of the many things that gets me, is the little boxes, the big boxes you find at the checkout, which are called ångervagnen. From the verb ångra, to regret. There's regret boxes. And there's a little sign above them which says, are you regretting? Do you want to change your mind? Do you regret what you've bought? Are you sure you're not going to hate yourself if you don't put one or two of those bottles back in this box? They don't serve any useful purpose because they're almost always empty. The point is that there's a message that the whole store is sending consistently in all of it, the way that it's organized and presented, and that is that alcohol is a bad thing and you should really think hard about using it.
And Becky, you've been looking at another recent study that showed that Systembolaget is the most popular company in Sweden, ahead of Volvo, ICA and IKEA. Why is Systembolaget so well liked?
I think, so the people I spoke to, I kind of asked every Swede I knew, and the ones who got back to me, it was very, very obvious that everyone said that the service is good. So that was the most common thing people said, that the service is very high quality. You can go in, you can ask, like, oh, I bought this wine last week and I liked that. Do you have anything that's similar? Or, oh, I'm looking for a wine from Georgia. Have you got any of them? And that someone will come and help you find something. And if they don't have it, you can order it in especially. And a lot of people also said that. So my husband made the point of you can buy a bottle of wine in Systembolaget for, let's say, 70 kroner. And you can ask the person in the Systembolaget, okay, what kind of food is this going to fit with? I'm having lamb for dinner. Is this going to suit that? And they go, oh, no, I'd recommend this, blah, blah, blah. And then in Denmark, for example, if you wanted that service, it's not like you can just go into your local supermarket and ask the teenager stacking the shelves, oh, is this wine going to pass with the lamb dish I'm having for dinner? Obviously, they're not going to know the answer to that. So if you want the same standard of service, you go to a wine shop, but then you'll be paying double the price for the wine because that service is kind of included in the cost of the wine in Denmark. Mm. And then obviously, if you buy something, so say you bought three bottles of wine and they're all the same wine, you drank one of them, you're like, oh, I don't really like this. You can go back to Systembolaget with an unopened bottle of alcohol. You don't need a receipt and you can just give it back to them and get the money back, which I think is a great kind of function. Especially if you're having a party and you buy alcohol for everybody and then some of it maybe doesn't get drunk, you can just go back to Systembolaget and hand it in again without the receipt and get all the money back, which is something I think is really good. My father-in-law was saying that it feels like they've got a high standard. It feels like they kind of only stock things that are good quality, that you're not getting any, like, just anything. You're getting things that they've tested and they know that are good. But then, like, some of my other friends were saying that one of the problems with Systembolaget is that they don't stock everything. So, like, if you're interested in natural wine, for example, Systembolaget don't really do that. So it's probably something you're going to have to order in from abroad if that's an interest that you've got, or go to a wine bar and buy there. If you travel to a distillery or something and you ask, oh, can I buy a bottle of your gin? It's like, well, no, you can drink it in our bar, or you can go to Systembolaget, which is something I really noticed when I was on Ven. It's the little island kind of near Landskrona and Denmark in the Øresund. And we went to Spirit of Ven, which is like a whiskey distillery. And I thought, oh, my dad loves whiskey. Maybe I'll get my bottle of whiskey. And then I suddenly realized, of course I can't get a bottle of whiskey. There's no Systembolaget on this whole island. If I want to buy something to take home from this distillery, I have to get a bus and then a ferry and then a train into Landskrona just to go to that Systembolaget to buy the same thing, which they literally produce here.
That's the other thing, is that there are so few Systembolaget stores. Until very recently, I think just a year or two ago, there were more golf courses in Sweden than shops where you could buy a bottle of wine over the counter. It's one Systembolaget store for every 23,000 in the population. So it's made very, very hard to get alcohol. At the bottom line, though, is you're absolutely right, Becky, that it works. People like it. It seems to have all these oddities and contradictions and things we don't like, but it does actually work for Swedish society. And I remember Richard said at the end of the last pod that with Sweden abandoning its non-alignment, it seems like the country has become just the same as anywhere else in Europe. But I would say that Systembolaget is an example of this of a very Swedish approach to the relationship between society and the economy, which is still alive in institutions like Systembolaget.
It does feel like we could talk about this like literally all day.
We could literally do a whole podcast on this.
Yeah,
easy. I think maybe we should do a podcast when actually drunk. That would be quite.
Becky, you've been looking at the Swedish newspaper landscape this week. Can you tell us, first of all, what the difference is between a morgontidning and a kvällstidning?
A morgontidning is basically a broadsheet, and a kvällstidning is a tabloid. So morgontidning means morning newspaper, and a kvällstidning is an evening newspaper. But like the reason they have these names is that a morgontidning was written and printed at night to be on your doorstep in the morning because you had a subscription to it. And then a kvällstidning was written during the day and then printed during the day, so you'd get it in the evening or at night.
Can you give us a few examples of morgontidnings and kvällstidnings?
So the most popular morgontidning, if we're looking on kind of a riksnivå, so like a countrywide level, would be SvD and DN. So that's Svenska Dagbladet and Dagens Nyheter. And then the most popular Kvällstidning are also kind of Sweden-wide. That's Aftonbladet and Expressen. But also regional newspapers are a really big thing in Sweden. So I would say most of the people I know in Skåne, where I live, who have a newspaper subscription, they don't subscribe to DN, they subscribe to Sydsvenskan, which is our kind of regional broadsheet, regional morgontidning.
Yeah, is there an explanation for why regional newspapers are quite strong in Sweden? Well, how do they survive financially?
I think part of it is Prestad, which is money that the government has historically, since the 1970s, given to newspapers that are in struggling markets, although it doesn't make up much of financing anymore. And also VAT on printed papers for a long time was 6% rather than 25%. And I think in 2019, that got extended to digital papers as well. So VAT is lower, and then you've got this press support, which makes it easier for the newspapers to work financially.
David, is that your experience in Gothenburg, that a lot of people subscribe to Göteborgs-Posten?
Yes, very much so. There is a sort of loyalty, I think, to the regional paper, which does some great journalism, but would have struggled to survive had it not been for the significant support it's had from the state. And similarly, I was talking to the editor of Borås Tidning just a couple of weeks ago. Borås is another major town not far from Gothenburg. And he said, you know, we wouldn't have got through the shift to the internet and so on had it not been for the state. And that really made me think. I think it's actually a healthy thing in the sense that, again, Swedish society kind of appreciates that news is a different, it's different from ordinary commodities, like alcohol, and therefore it has to be regulated in a different way, and there's more sense of public service in the media and in journalism in Sweden as a result.
Mm. I was speaking to Maria Gassetti, who's a researcher at Gothenburg University, and she said that one thing that's really striking about Swedish media is how, if you look at the stories that are published in all the papers every day, they tend to cover the same main stories every day, and there's less variation than there is in most countries' media. Sweden is, again, as a consensus society, there's a sort of, everyone sort of agrees, and it's often set by TT or Eircott, you know, or the calendar, the government's calendar. There's a sort of almost consensus amongst news editors as to what are the big stories of the day.
If you just explain to people who might not be aware what TT is and its role in the media environment.
Oh, sorry, yeah. TT is the sort of the main and I suppose really the only news wire. They have a lot of reporters and they cover up in all the regions and they cover most of the stories and they also take most of the photographs. But they also have quite a forward-looking thing. They have a calendar which sort of plots the day's stories ahead. And I think a lot of people have that in mind when they're planning what we're going to do next week and what's going on. So there's more of a consensus as to what are the stories coming up and what is the news calendar.
Now on to the main topic for today, where we're going to shine a light on organisational culture in the Swedish workplace, and in particular, the style of leadership characterised by so-called flat hierarchies that is often said to predominate here. To find out whether that's actually the case, I spoke yesterday to Pernilla Petrelius Karlberg, a lecturer at the Stockholm School of Economics and a researcher at the Centre for Responsible Leadership. And I started by asking her if Sweden does in fact have a distinctive management style. And I should mention that when I spoke to her, she was in a cafe, so there will be a little bit of background noise.
I think the core of what we talk about when we talk about Swedish leadership is the fact that leaders and managers offer co-workers to take ownership in the task and in the business and running the business. It's even expected. And also co-workers take that ownership. They engage and they take responsibility for the outcome and the result. So it's the total opposite to micromanagement in that sense. It's also reflected in what we expect from managers. So in a sort of, if you generalize, in a Swedish setting, if there is a meeting with the boss, the co-workers will expect to be listened to and to be involved in a conversation and give their opinion on things. And that is also a way to motivate people.
When can a decision be said to have been taken in a Swedish workplace environment?
It's in a way it's a different process which often involves calculated a plan for taking time for introducing the decision, for discussing it, for making people feel that they have been involved, informed, engaged. So in a sense, the decisions are in that sense taken in a much more informal way and can be more difficult to sort of pinpoint exactly when that was decided. And we also saw that during the pandemic, that the Swedish organization, which is very non-hierarchical, suffered a lot because a lot of leadership was actually practiced in the non-formal or informal work environment. And when people were taking away from that environment, because suddenly they were working from home, they were sort of, you know, how do we practice leadership now? Whereas in an organization with much sort of clear hierarchy, it was never an issue where the decisions were made or how leadership was practiced, because it was done in a different way.
Is it an effective leadership style?
I would say it is, yes. And we stand out as a nation, we stand out pretty well when it comes to different types of national measurements of competitiveness, etc. So we score quite high on that.
And you presumably have students who come from different cultures. Do you see that people find it difficult to adapt to the Swedish style?
It can be quite a shock, of course. But I do think that at least the one I meet, and maybe that's because they're still around, they appreciate it. They like it. And especially on our young students who want to play a bigger part and take a lot of responsibility at an early stage, this can be a very good environment for them to explore. I do see also, of course, that some people sort of, they have to sit on their hands and they just tell themselves that this is Sweden and now I just have to sit and wait and let them talk this through, even though it's very, very frustrating.
What is it that's so frustrating? Is it that they just want to be told what to do?
Or tell what to do. This is how we're going to do it. I already thought it through. It's a great idea and it's practiced everywhere else. And you're going to come to the same conclusion. It's just going to take you forever to talk it through.
That was Pernilla Petrelius-Karlberg giving her thoughts on the consensus-based style of Swedish leadership. Now, David, you interviewed quite a lot of foreigners in Sweden about this for your book. What did people tell you about how the Swedish approach compared to management styles in their home countries?
Yes, I tried to speak to foreign business figures with experience, obviously, abroad, but also of doing business here in Sweden. But also, I tried to talk to Swedish business figures who had been abroad and tried to set up companies abroad, particularly in the United States, just to get some idea of the contrast between how business is done in here in Sweden and in other countries. And it's obviously it's hard to generalize because every workplace is different and individuals have different management styles. But certainly a pattern seemed to emerge that a much greater stress is put on individual initiative in Sweden rather than ordering people about and managing them in a very hands-on, direct way. And Swedish business people complained that when they're in the States, American employees just will sit around and do nothing until they're given orders. And they don't expect to criticize or discuss, whereas there's a healthier culture of answering back, of saying, well, maybe that's not the right way to do it. And particularly in sophisticated high-tech companies where employees have PhDs, you know, they read daily newspapers, you can't expect a CEO to be absolutely across everything that's happening in that company. They need to encourage employees to take initiative and to be proactive and forward thinking. And in that sense, a flat hierarchy and a workplace culture in which the manager is not giving orders left, right, and center is a very sensible way, a very effective way of running a business.
Yeah, I think I definitely noticed this. So I've only worked for the local in Sweden, but when I worked in Denmark, I had a Swedish boss. But previous to that Swedish boss, I had a German boss, and I could really see the difference in the German and Swedish management styles. where my German boss, you know, this is probably a stereotype, but they definitely both kind of fit these stereotypes. My German boss, it was very much like, this is what we're doing, this is how we do it, and if you don't know what to do, talk to your direct superior. And then the Swedish boss, it was like, oh, I'm not entirely sure how we should do this. Why don't we call a meeting with everyone in the department who's going to be working on this project, and we'll all discuss it, and you can come with your comments, and I'm definitely not the expert on this, so come on, guys, let's have a consensus on this.
IKEA made a splash in Germany in particular when it brought its Swedish management style into Germany in the 1980s, I think it was, where they did away with ties, which was a big deal for managers not to wear a suit and tie on the shop floor. Managers were on first name terms with all the staff as well, and it became a recruiting tool, an effective recruiting tool for IKEA to say to Germans, come and work for us and experience this egalitarian Swedish workplace culture. I know there's a lot of academic effort has gone into trying to pin down what this Swedish management style is, and I'm not aware that anybody has kind of written the book on the Swedish management style. It's sort of something that has emerged out of a historical conjuncture in Sweden, thanks to the unions having such an incredibly powerful voice in the workplace over many decades. And it seems to me almost as though Swedish business has made a virtue out of necessity by recognizing that employees need to have a voice, and it actually can be very beneficial to the business. And I came across the Swedish concept of medarbetarskap, which is translated as employeeship, which is a concept, very much a Swedish concept. It's not being discussed in the in a non-Swedish economics literature very much. But the idea is that you create a culture of initiative and employeeship, where the employee takes on a responsibility for the business. That's the other side of that's what you're expected to give in return for having this kind of liberal and open relationship with senior management. And so, yeah, medarbetarskap seems to at least put a formal academic name on something that we're sometimes struggling to describe or to understand.
In general, I think that because there's sort of less overt competition, people don't work as hard. It's not as kind of high tempo and high energy as in, you know, a dynamic American workplace. But there's so much effort that is wasted in the UK, in a lot of UK offices, just kind of fighting internal battles against your sort of your office rival, and, you know, trying to get that to justify your bonus in a bank or something like that. And there's so much less of that in Sweden. People are so much more focused on doing their job, I feel. And like you say, there's so much human capital goes to waste. It doesn't go to waste in Sweden, that it sort of makes up for the fact that there's maybe less kind of energy and dynamism.
I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, you can actually focus on your job if you know. Yeah, if you know that you can speak, you don't have to kind of think, oh, how am I going to break this to my boss that I think that this is a bad way of doing things? And maybe you can be more efficient because everyone who has a possible idea can come to the table with their idea. It's not based on what your job title is. It's based on whether you've got any good ideas. And then you can come and say, you can go up to your boss and say, hey, I don't think this is a good way that we're doing this. Here's another suggestion, without being worried that it's going to backfire.
I did an article on office politics in Sweden, you know, because it's not utopia. You know, there is still competition between employees, and people said that they found that what annoyed them most is that rather than take a conflict face to face, you know, for even minor conflicts like who's eating the fruit or who's eating too many fruit in the office fruit bowl, people would go directly up to the superior. And this was a superior who was going, it drives me crazy, I feel like I'm running a kindergarten, because my employees are constantly coming up with these minor complaints which I'm expected to get involved with, and I have to sort of micromanage all of these sort of disputes that no one will take face to face. which is maybe the disadvantage of the flat hierarchy, that there isn't such a, you know, I would have been terrified of going to any of my bosses in the UK with,
yeah, they'd be like, sort it out yourself. I've not got enough time to do this.
You're fired immediately.
When I worked at a small Swedish multinational here in Gothenburg, my manager really did conform to the picture of a Swedish management style, in the sense that she let me get on with my tasks and had an overview and would step in if I wandered away from too far away from the plan. But she wasn't conscious of that. That was just the way that she went about her work. And I think if there is a Swedish management style, I would say that Swedish managers themselves aren't particularly aware of it. They're just, this is what they do, and it is different. And it could be useful to hold up a mirror to Swedish business and industry to say, you've actually got something here which is a little bit different and which can be a very effective way of running a modern organisation, and it's worth being more explicitly aware of what that brings to a workplace situation and the positive things that it means in hard-nosed productivity terms, not just in terms of good relationships with employees.
That takes us to the end of this week's Sweden in Focus. Thank you for listening. And thank you to David Crouch, Richard Orange and Becky Waterton, and this week's special guest, Pernilla Petrelius-Kolbe. Please share your feedback about the podcast in our survey, which you can find in the episode description in your app. And we'll be back again next Saturday. Until then, take care. That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.